You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Wind sounds. What's that sound? The air is crisp. I feel like I have a friend coming over. Vidtober. When it tastes and feels and smells and sounds like a video you've never seen. When you close your eyes and open them and you're still on that tracking screen. Vidtober. You never know what to expect. Vidtober. Wind sounds. Close that window and enjoy Vidtober. Music.
Welcome to New World Pictures Podcast, where we're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
How are the rental rates for this one at Ridebusters?
It's pretty affordable. It's pretty affordable. Oh, it's a 99 center.
Good to know. Oh, wow.
And Erica.
It's too bad I already employ you guys, because if I didn't, I would be employing you to close the old house down for the winter. Fold up the chairs. Come with me on a horse ride.
And we are in the midst of Vidtober 2, That's right. I'm sticking with it. I'm sticking with it. It's terrible. It's bad.
No.
And I'm leaning into how bad I have
done
this.
That's not what we agreed upon.
We are discussing the movies released by New World Video, and specifically the Canadian movies released by New World Video. Joining us, a first-time guest. He is one of the hosts of the You Don't Know Dick podcast on Cinema Smorgasbord, where we have been on a few times. Please welcome to the show, Doug Tilley.
No applause, please. Not necessary. Thank you so much. So good to be here. Look, this is a real treat. I feel like you're bringing me in as a ringer because we're going to be talking about a Canadian film today, but I appreciate it. I like to be able to put some expertise towards this movie, really representative of the kind of Canadian movies I was raised watching.
Wow. I feel like this is going to turn into a therapy session.
Hey, basically it's the subject matter we are all raised on here in Canada.
It's true. It's true. Mm-hmm. Okay. Doug, tell us about Cinema Smorgasbord. I know that we have been on You Don't Know Dick, but there's a variety of podcasts. So just to mention one is to ignore the others. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it would be offensive just to bring up one. Can I swear I have to ask because...
Of course. No, please.
Cinema Smorgasbord evolved out of the late... beloved podcast, Eric Roberts is the Fucking Man. We did that for years and years, and we still do it over at Cinema Smorgasbord, our podcast devoted to Eric Roberts, but we decided that we wanted to open up to basically themed podcasts under the umbrella name of Cinema Smorgasbord. So we have podcasts devoted to such diverse topics as the career of Carol Kane, George Kennedy, Alejandro Jodorowsky. We just recently started a podcast about the films of Kiyoshi Kurosawa. We have Oliver Reed podcast. We, of course, still have Eric Roberts, Jackie Chan, Carol Kane. Did I already say Carol Kane? Dick Miller, of course. We can't stop launching podcasts over at cinemasmorgasbord.com. I will say once you spend 4 years only watching Eric Roberts movies, every week is a new delight when you don't have to watch an Eric Roberts movie.
considering we are on our sixth anniversary and have watched nothing but New World movies, we know exactly what you're going through.
It's a blessing and a curse, right? But I mean, you know, yes. Sometimes when I start up a new, like I get an idea, it's like, you know, I don't think anyone ever started a George Kennedy themed podcast before. And then you start one and you immediately realize why. No one would ever listen to a George Kennedy themed podcast. And now I have to devote literally the rest of my life to it.
But that is what is great about all the podcasts you've started. They are all extremely good and they're a lot of fun to listen to. So we recommend everybody go over to Cinema. Do you have a website? Cinemasmorgasbord.com?
Yeah, and it's even harder to spell than it is to say. So it's a real, real delight. We once had on our George Kennedy podcast, we had a George Kennedy enthusiast from Sweden come on as a guest. And not only was he very upset at my co-host because they did not like The Naked Gun, which is one of the few kind of universally beloved George Kennedy movies.
Yeah.
But also, he was very upset at me for my pronunciation of smorgasbord. But what am I going to do? I'm Canadian.
I'm not saying it well, and I'm not from Canada. But...
Oh, man, he would hate the way I say things. Like something I'll talk about later in this episode, which is the beautiful negligees that were featured. Yeah.
Yes, there's negligees.
Now, we really have to get something straight right at the beginning, right? Of course, this movie is Canadian, but it's also French-Canadian, right? Because it takes place in Quebec.
Oh, la la!
Right.
It's in Montreal, correct?
That's right. And we get to see like downtown Montreal at one point in the movie. But of course, I was raised on the far eastern point of Canada in Newfoundland. I live in Ontario now. And of course, even though they taught us to be as bilingual as we could be growing up, my French is a little rusty, so I might not be able to translate things as accurately as I'd like to in this episode.
All right. Well, okay, thank you for coming. You should go.
Sorry.
You should go. Sorry. Merci for coming. You should go.
Au revoir, everybody.
Bon voyage, Doug.
So that said, Doug, because you are from Canada, Did you know about this movie when I presented you with this movie because you had no choice in the matter, and when I and I told you this is the one we're talking about? Did you know of the movie?
I knew of it, but didn't know I knew of it. Meaning that I'd heard of it before, but the title just didn't ring a bell when you sent it over to me initially, and then I just did like a little bit of kind of initial research, and I think I was introduced to the movie just reading Paul Kurup's write-ups on it, the Canucksploitation kind of expert.
Yes.
And once I connected it to the idea that, it might be embarrassing to listeners who don't know much about Canadian film history. Like, this was an early Canadian horror movie. Like, this is early for us, The first in color, right. I mean, there was the Mask that came before it, but this is the one that, I mean, this isn't the one, but I mean, this is kind of a breakthrough Canadian horror movie. And the fact that it's really following in the footsteps of what was popular several years earlier in the US, you can really feel that it's kind of trailing behind trends. But then again, as we, I'm sure, going to talk about, it was filmed in 1965, didn't come out till years later.
Yeah, yeah. So it took some time to get out. And I got a lot of information from They Came From Within, which is a history of Canadian horror cinema by Calum Vautinstall. So
Caleb, of course, was a guest on our very first, I believe, episode of You Don't Know Dick, because he wrote the book on Dick Miller.
He did. And so I learned a lot from this book about Canadian movies in general. And we talk about a lot of Canadian movies here. So as we've said, let's get to it. 1967's The Playgirl Killer.
Artist or killer. Temptress or playgirl.
No, don't move. Don't move!
A fascinating, eerie story of a mad killer who loved to paint beautiful women and then murder them only because they moved.
No, don't move! Don't move!
You will cringe with terror in this nightmare of horror as this devilish fiend paints his warped masterpieces. A shattering, unforgettable, psychedelic experience that will hold you spellbound on the edge of your seat.
Ah!
You must see Playgirl Killer in shivering color.
That's right, 1967's The Playgirl Killer, brought to you by Bill's Socks and Sandals, the perfect footwear for the rugged outdoor adventurer. Whether you're running through the forest to escape from the police, riding a horse, or canoeing downriver, Bill's Socks and Sandals offer comfort, support, and style. Trust us, you're going to get attention from that special someone in Bill's Socks and Sandals almost instantly. Once you try Bill's Socks and Sandals, you'll wonder, do other shoes even exist?
I'm so mad about that. If at any point, listeners, if you don't know this, Ryan and I are married. If at any point Ryan in our courtship would have strolled up with socks and sandals on, deal breaker. It's over.
Would have been off. That's it. It would have been off.
It's off. It is off.
And it seems to only accentuate his game that he has socks and sandals. Does not hurt him.
And he's wearing like the 1960s equivalent of Teva sandals, which socks and Teva sandals is the clear-cut sign that this guy's a stone-cold killer.
Yeah, indeed.
I mean, that goatee, right? I mean, that's really the extra little spice. And especially, I mean, look, let's face it. There's something kind of intriguing about an American wandering around the countryside, the Quebec countryside. they spot him and they're like, they just, women just throw themselves at this guy.
Yeah.
This odd looking middle-aged man.
This movie was directed by Eric Santamaria, who also directed this. Santamaria was a co-writer who actually stepped up to direct this after the initial director, Montreal's Martin Green, was fired after a few days of shooting. Green would go on to direct 1966 Footsteps in the Snow with Veronica Lake, while Santamaria would direct, according to Letterboxd, three Spanish language films, La Massacre de Ponce, La Tormenta, and Los Hijos del... I can't even read what that says. There's three of them, and he apparently directed
weird that the title.
Guess I'm not the only one who's not bilingual around here.
Los Hijos del Vecio. I can't read it because it's the poster. I took a picture of it. So this stars William Kerwin, as Doug, you were saying. He's a star of many Herschel Gordon Lewis films. In fact, Kerwin starred in two out of the three of Lewis's Blood Trilogy films, starting with 1963 Blood Feast and then 1964's 2000 Maniacs. But Kerwin is absent from Color Me Blood Red, which is about an artist who uses his victim's blood for his paintings. And he missed it because he was shooting this. Now, it's speculated because Kerwin and his brother Harry came up with a story for this movie that they were probably coming up with a movie for Lewis to direct. But then he decided not to, and he made his version. And then, I guess, Kerwin ran up to Canada to make this instead, but very similar movies.
Hmm.
I mean, kind of all similar to A Bucket of Blood, too, right? I mean, it all feels like they have kind of similar DNA. I just like the idea that Herschel Gordon Lewis is ripping off A Bucket of Blood, and Harry Kerwin and William Kerwin are like, we can rip it off, too. Come on, do our version of the ripoff. Hey, as long as everyone's getting paid, I guess it's okay.
And also, you know, in our Corman Graduates Jack Hill series, we talked about Bloodbath, and especially the Jack Hill portions of Bloodbath. Not the other vampire portions, but his portions are also about like a mad killer who is an artist. So that was just a thing that everybody was like, this is what we got to do, I guess.
We've just recently on our Paul Bartel podcast, which I didn't mention earlier, covered a episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, which was the 80s version of the Alfred Hitchcock the show from the 60s, where they remade all the episodes, I guess. Except this remake was done by Tim Burton, of all people. Tim Burton directed it. Danny Elfman doing the music. Paul Bartel stars Griffin Dunne. And they really, it's an adaptation of a Ray Bradbury story. The reason I bring it up is the original Ray Bradbury story was adapted pretty accurately in the 1960s version of Alfred Hitchcock. This is not related to it whatsoever, but it's very similar where an artist, you know, uses, in this case, it's a jar full of something that people are kind of obsessed with, but eventually uses murder in his artistic creations. Apparently, if you are in the film business You're just fascinated with the idea of killing people for your art.
Yep, pretty much. I mean, especially at this time. It was very hip, I guess.
This is a weird place and time to admit it, but I have murdered several people who have been on the podcast.
Yeah. This is actually the best time to admit it.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, then, yeah. I mean, it's just a natural, you know, when you're an artist and, you know, people don't listen to your strict rules, it's time to die.
I listen to some people's voices, and after 5 minutes, I'm like, that guy got to die.
Yes.
They must
That's
be murdered.
Actually a real thing. There are podcasts I cannot listen to because I don't like the sound of the person's voice.
Hey, so I list them. I list every one of them right now.
No.
Can I start with me? Because I don't listen to podcasts because I can't stand my voice.
I feel that way when I edit. I'm like, that's what I sound like? That's my laugh? Like, what do I sound so ridiculous? Like right now, I'm like, why am I talking so high?
I'll be editing one of my podcasts and I will laugh at something. And my wife is like, are you laughing at your own fucking joke right now?
Here's where you can watch The Playgirl Killer. We know after that intro, you're going to want to watch it. There is a copy on YouTube. It is slightly edited, I do have to say, but that is probably the one that is most easily available to you, is there's a version on YouTube. We'll see if we can get one on YouTube, because you could also watch this DVD from Platinum Discs of The Playgirl Killer. This is back when they were doing like CD cases for DVDs back in the early 2000s. But now let's talk about what this movie is about. Mark, what is The Playgirl Killer about?
First, I want to say, for those people that are trying to rent this movie on Ridebuster, be careful. That cover is not the movie. It's very important. Yeah. Yeah. That looks like a movie from the 90s that would otherwise show up in Sextember. And this movie is definitely doesn't fall into that category.
Don't worry, Mark. At Ridebusters, we have it filed under bait and switch.
Oh,
we have a whole category. Bait and switch section.
much like the New World Video cover as well, which again was like trying to lure people. It was like a man and a woman, and he's holding a knife behind her back, but they're in the throes of some kind of lovemaking. And I'm like, that's not this movie. It just trying to lure you into watching this movie in whatever way they can.
You could almost have marketed it in the 90s in the kind of something weird VHS era.
Sure.
Like marketing it as like it was like a extension of that H.G. Lewis universe, particularly by putting like William Kirwan on like the cover. You probably could have gotten away with that because it does have not just thematic similarities to the Lewis movies at the time. It kind of looks like one too. It's just missing a couple of elements, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, that you would normally find in those movies.
Yes. Yes.
So what is this movie about, you asked? Thanks for asking, Ryan.
I asked earlier.
Well, and I'm thanking you for it. If you took Jack Hill's bloodbath, turned Antonio Sordi into a lonely drifter, removed all the vampire stuff, swapped out Europe for an estate in Canada, replaced the beatniks with some mods, made a bad dream, one bad dream, the motivation for murder instead of impotence, and replaced wax embalming with a walk-in freezer, you'd have the Playgirl Killer.
It's very true. It's very true.
So many swaps.
Well, but if you do all those little subtle changes,
just a few tweaks, and there you go.
Hair extensions and a facelift and breast implants and complete vocal cord replacement. And I learned to play the guitar. I would be Dolly Parton. It's just that simple.
Right. Just a pinch of harpoon murder, just a dash of Neil Sedaka. I mean, and then it's basically the exact same thing.
Exactly. Exactly my point. Thank you. Thank you for getting my back, Doug. I appreciate it.
Doug, what is The Playgirl Killer about?
It's about how important it is to have a walk-in freezer in your home. I mean, it's really the most really important true, thing really, to really do. True. I mean, not only is it cost-effective, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you can store all sorts of things in there. Honestly, it's an essential piece of kit if you're going to be an artist who is obsessed, as a certain artist in this movie is, with women being quiet and still. Now, I mean, personally, I married someone who's never still and is never quiet, and that's the way that I like things. But I'm not really an artist. I'm a podcaster. I'm the opposite of an artist. So really, I mean, I also don't have a walk-in freezer, so obviously I'm at a loss in a lot of different ways. But I mean, really, this movie just shows that there is kind of two necessities to be an artist. You need a walk-in freezer, and you need consistent power. And that's a real issue if you end up losing that, unfortunately.
Critical. Critical.
That's just true. Like Bloodbath.
Erica, what is Playgirl Killer about?
Playgirl Killer tells the time-old tale. That's something people say.
That's an expression for sure.
The time-old tale. The tale as old as... What's the expression?
It's the Beauty and the Beast.
The timeless tale.
Time-old tale.
The timeless tale. The timeless tale.
There you go. Yeah. Timeless.
The timeless tale of... If you have art talent, it doesn't matter what you look like. Ladies are going to go for you.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got it, go for it.
I agree. But for me, watching this, I felt like this is actually a Montreal music scene video that guest stars Neil Sedaka, where the guy who's making the interstitials between bands, he just got a little carried away with the narrative.
Right, right. Yeah.
He went a little nuts, dude. It's not supposed to be this long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a precursor to Michael Jackson's Thriller video where they wrapped a whole story. This one just happened to be an hour.
That's definitely what I was thinking when watching it. This is definitely a precursor to Thriller.
Yeah, it's obvious. I think when you watch it, it's obvious.
Was Neil Sedaka too famous to be in this movie when it was made? Because in the early 60s he was pretty big, right? Like he was a big musical artist up until the point where exactly the kind of musicians that he was being accompanied by in the musical sequence in this movie kind of destroyed that style of music. But I mean, I know he's a special guest in the movie, but he was still pretty big, right? Mid-60s?
He was pretty big, and I'm sure, and I know it was quite a get, and I also know that this is the first and last movie he ever made. But I would imagine...
That's too bad, because he really mastered this.
Oh, that's Bill Kerwin. Oh, yeah. That's Bill Kerwin. Yeah. Which one's Neil Sedaka? Neil Sedaka is the brother who sings a song at the party.
The water bug boy.
And then he takes off like about 15 minutes in and never to be seen again.
He gets very easily seduced in exactly the way that William Kerwin's character is very difficult to seduce.
Correct.
Got it. Right. Boy, what a different... What changes things for Erica's point? POV. This movie.
I'm embarrassed to admit that when I started watching the movie, I had confused Neil Sedaka with Paul Anka.
I know
that it's a little embarrassing to say because Paul Anka is partially Canadian. It made all the sense in the world to me that he would be in this movie, right? They probably got some tax credits because of having a Canadian staff. A lot of the supporting cast are Canadian already. I thought it was going to be Paul Anka. I was very disappointed. I like Paul Anka. He's okay. Not such a big Neil Sedaka guy.
Yeah, not as much on Neil Sedaka.
I think if you are a Sedaka head, this is a real get. Like, dude, did you see him in the Playgirl Killer?
Yeah, you're not a real Sedaka head unless you're rocking your own.
And you get to see him in the pool. That's
your own
thing,
DVD.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, with a shirt off?
Yeah,
with a
shirt
Hello. Yeah.
Is this like getting like a pristine copy of The Cure in Orange?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm trying to think. Are there any attractive men in this movie?
That's a good point. Bartender's pretty handsome.
That's a fine point, actually.
Yeah, that is.
But
that
he's
is
not
true.
An artist, so pass. No. Smash or pass.
Well, we don't get to have his drinks. We don't know if he's like an artist with like the cocktails. You know,
he was very appreciative of the art being made in front of him. He was like, "Wow, wowie, wow! Look at that guy."
Yeah, don't turn to him for red flags. I was like, he is killing this woman. He is an accomplice. He is absolutely an accomplice.
Let's go to the Letterboxd synopsis. Now, Doug, you were on Letterboxd, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because a lot of our guests, we ask and they are not. But you are. What? So follow Doug, follow us on Letterboxd. Here's what they say. A rich, lonely woman hires a drifter. Hold on. She's rich for sure. She's not, she may, lonely's a stretch. She is by herself in that house for about 10 minutes, basically.
And not even. I think she went right to the garage door. I mean, immediately after her father left. I mean, hey, you know what? Lonely comes in a lot of different forms and a lot of different speeds.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm.
But I think we can settle on the fact that she was a lonely.
Yes.
She's alone. Yeah. She's alone. She hires a drifter as a live-in handyman. Sort of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kind of.
He shows his skills. He can close a door.
He can.
He can fold a chair.
The drifter turns out to be a psycho artist who has beautiful women model for him. I mean, he has beautiful women model for him once he murders them. But yeah,
for once Letterboxd is, you know, exercising a little discretion and maybe not telling the entire movie in their description. So somebody actually maybe watched a little bit of it.
It's one of those time old kind of synopses.
Yeah, time old tales. Thank you. It's a tot. Thank you. It's a tot. Thanks, Ryan. Thank you.
As we mentioned, we do start with that canoe ride with Bill in his socks and sandals. Totally normal to wear that in the outdoors. And he takes a girl, and I guess he's going to draw them. They don't say anything. We don't, and also never saw a harpoon gun until he grabs it and kills her with it. I don't know. I guess he left it there in advance overnight, and then he just said, this looks like a good spot. I'm giving the movie tons of credit that it doesn't deserve. But anyway, that is how we open the movie, and we do see that he is a murderer who does this in broad daylight and is immediately chased by cops. But
those type of sandals, they've got grip, and he could just, I mean,
I'm just thinking of a cop going, what's that? Is that the sound of a harpoon gun? You also got kind of the impression during that whole opening sequence and for most of the rest of the movie that the cost of recording audio was such that they're going to do it as sparsely as possible.
Yeah, for sure. That's where you really spend the dollars. That's right. What's interesting to me about this movie is that it takes a little while, but eventually Bill Kerwin is our main character. And there's only so many movies where you have the main character is an antagonist. What do you guys think about that kind of move? Doesn't happen a lot. Not to say that this is the 1960s version of Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, but but in terms of a movie where an antagonist is the main guy, you know, basically. How do you
feel
about
basically
that?
The Canadian man bites dog. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, do you really want them to cut every 15 minutes to a RCMP officer being like, hey, there's someone killing off these ladies around here.
Right.
And right. I mean, it makes it unique. It's also different than the kind of Herschel Gordon Lewis movies that it seems to be in the mold of to a certain extent. And
which would immediately cut to cops. In fact, that's what Bill Kerwin plays in Blood Feast.
Bill Kerwin probably would have been the cop. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wish we don't get much of his interior life or his psychological profile, but we get a little bit. So, I mean, at least I kind of wish that they went a little harder. You know, that trailer mentions the psychedelic visuals. We don't really get any of that, but at least when we get that kind of dream, when he's describing his dream, it gets kind of visually interesting for a moment. It kind of reminds you, hey, there were people who could have made a visually striking movie, which this, for the most part, I think we can all agree, isn't.
No, it's not. Yeah. But neither is Blood Feast, really. That's not really like a stylistic kind of movie.
It's got a color to it.
Oh, snap.
It's got a color to it.
Is this a segment of Blood Feast?
A particular kind of color. Mark, what do you think about an antagonist as the main character?
I mean, it worked in Maniac, so I think it can work, but you have to have an antagonist that's interesting. And though they introduce that he had this dream, and this dream has haunted him for, you know, X number of times, whatever, years or what have you. But there isn't a sense, and normally when you have an antagonist that is the hero, or at least the lead, or that there's something about this person, there's a vulnerability, there's something about them that endears you to them in some way. And there's nothing in this movie to make you like him. He doesn't have, he's a tortured soul, but not in a way that you have compassion. You're just like,
not like Maniac where you're kind of going, oh man, this guy's all kinds of messed up. And you almost in a way kind of root, like, can he get it together?
Yeah. But can he get it together?
I disagree on all of this. I mean, this guy's basically the Jared Leto of his time, right? Someone with such artistic skill that he can be a piece of garbage, right?
Yeah,
because we see him, he can paint sometimes. Pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, he's a good sketch artist.
On set, I believe William Kerwin did tell everybody, you have to call me Bill. And they were like, your name, Bill, or the character's name? He's like, just, I'm Bill, okay? And they're like, okay, wow. A very Leto move.
And he was mailing shit.
Any other names.
He was mailing shit to all of his co-stars as well for no reason whatsoever.
Okay, let's turn our attention to the only female lead of the film, Arlene, who somehow has the trust of her quite old father. I don't really understand it, but let's listen in.
Oh, by the way, when are you leaving? Tomorrow?
Yes, I'm going to drop Betty and Bob off at college, and then I'm going to fly to Africa. A little hunting, you know.
Oh, Dad! Oh, bring me back a nice big lion.
hold on, two quick things. Bob's in college?
Yeah.
Okay.
Student over on average, totally reasonable.
getting his doctorate. I understand he's getting his doctorate.
In college, he's at college.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fair.
She just said, that's right. He just says he's dropping him off at college.
At college. Well, here we are at college. Enjoy, children.
And 35-year-old man who sings in my backyard.
Yes, my 21-year-old daughter is perfectly suited for you.
He just hangs around the dorm rooms.
Yeah, he's just like an RA, just a permanent RA.
So, guys, I've been an RA here for 6 years.
All I know is lights off at 10 and do the water bug.
The other thing is I'm very worried about her dad because when she gets out of the pool, he has a gun squarely pointed at her. This guy's going on a hunting trip and doesn't know the basics of muzzle control.
Yeah.
He is not, he's either going to kill somebody or be killed on this hunting trip.
Yeah.
He's going alone. He's going solo to an African hunt. Like, I'm like, I hope that there are people on the other end of that plane that are there to help you and guide you, sir. Cause
please,
I'm very nervous.
Yeah.
So he has a daughter that's college age. And he appears to be right around 103 years old.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Keeping those swimmers virile.
I also felt like he was maybe himself being carted off to the nursing home. And he was like, I'm going to Africa on a hunting trip. And she's like, sure you are, Dad. Have fun.
Yeah. Driving to college, huh? Yeah. All right. Fair. Yeah.
Arlene, by the way, is played by Jean Christopher, who had been on a sketch show called Nightcap. And she was engaged at the time that they shot this movie. She was engaged to impressionist Rich Little.
Oh, okay. so goes to show you that if you are funny and an artist, aka Rich Little, you got the riz. You got the huzz.
That's it.
That's it.
Yep. You pulled the huzz. You've got the riz. I don't know. I might have those in the wrong order, but
let the kids sort that out.
Yeah. The youngs can sort that out.
We talked about this already. This pool party. This is the best pool party to a point that I've ever seen. There's bands. There's a lot going on. Dad, for being an old dude, is really letting a lot happen.
He's certainly not stopping things from happening.
No.
I'm sure. He knows this is his last pool party that he's lightly supervising.
My daughter's undressing in front of everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
My daughter and her love for cabaret. Ah, well. But we have JB and the Playboys, who were Canada's Beatles at the time, or at least talked about in such grand terms
in
the mid-60s. They would not survive to the movie actually opening up years after it was made. They died? Did not. They were killed in a they broke up. They were killed by a mysterious artist. They were found frozen inside of a walk-in freezer.
No, they were killed by the prime minister when they just didn't live up to the Beatles' name, unfortunately.
They're like, you're an embarrassment to Canada.
but they're back. JB and the Playboys, they're back and touring.
Oh, really? Okay, so they got back together then.
They reunited as JB and the Playboys 2.0, and I'm not lying. You can go to their website, and they are touring with some of the original members. Now, it's funny because the website has their touring dates, but it doesn't have a year attached to them, so maybe this is old news. But at one point, they did, at least as of 6 years ago, because I saw a news report, and I know that Alan Nichols, who was like the lead singer, lead creative force, who then went on to like work with Robert Altman as an actor for years.
Oh, wow.
He's in Popeye and Nashville and all sorts of things. But he's back with the band, or was with the band. And also you can find their sole recording effort on Spotify. Before we started recording, I was listening to it. If you're like a Beatles-y guy, because remember, this was filmed in 1965. So it's funny because it comes out in 68. The whole musical kind of landscape had changed at that point. But if you like that kind of Beatles-y pop, it's pretty darn good. Not Canada's answer to the Beatles, Montreal's answer to the Beatles.
Yeah, fair. Was I had read that's what somebody said. It was Canada's answer to the Beatles, but I mean, yes, very, very.
I talked
true.
To some Canadians; they disagreed.
Fair enough.
Rush is Canada's answer to the Beatles.
There you go.
Nice.
What is not also Canada's answer to anything is Neil Sedaka performing Waterbug.
And everyone have fun and Waterbug.
A song I think he thought was going to kill. I'm sure the producers thought, oh, we got a real hit and this movie's going to just take off, everybody. But not a huge track in his discography, from what I understand.
Also, this scene, besides the fact that for a good 10 minutes of the movie, we have two songs played from start to finish and then people dancing around the pool, and it just... It goes to show that some dance moves don't ever rejoin the zeitgeist and become trendy again.
They're of their time.
They are of their time.
Yeah.
And they stayed in that time.
Yeah.
It is kind of like, old, it's kind of like time captured old, in amber a little bit, right?
Time because old moves.
Yeah.
Time old
Thank
moves.
Thank you, but, Tots.
Like the idea that like a dance craze is like a twist, right? And all that sort of thing. Like if it was like 63, 64, I mean, I'm not saying the Waterbug is going to drive people nuts, but it may have had a chance. But I mean, this was competing against what, the Monterey Pop Festival? I mean, it just doesn't seem like maybe Neil Sedaka was just like, get that movie out there, that song is gonna kill. And then it just one day the time had passed.
Yeah But why leave Arlene in charge? She has to close up their summer house, and we all lived in our summer homes. We all know how difficult that is. I mean, all of us grew up with summer homes. This is a very relatable film with relatable things that everyone did.
Do you mean my home when it's summer? When it's summertime out?
Like when you have to close it at night because we're all going to sleep? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Normally you close up, though, a second home in the fall because you close it up for winter. Why are they closing up in summer?
Summer's theoretically, it's September, right? If they're going back to college, it just happens to be a balmy September.
They're going. Yeah. They're going at college. I just want to make sure that they're going at college. They're not going to or in. I just think it's funny that she's the one. Luckily, though, as we mentioned, she finds some good help in the literal only man walking down by the street, who helps her close her garage door. So she instantly offers him a job and room and board, as you do. Because no one wants the full responsibility of closing up summer home. And so she asks him to do so in the horniest way she can.
I don't want to sound presumptuous, but could you use a job for a couple of days? I'll need some help to close up the house for the summer. You know, wash the car, drain the pool.
Car.
Clean the freezer.
Oh.
That type of work.
Uh-oh.
You know?
Dropping that freezer.
I can pay you $15 a day.
What's the matter? None of the boys around?
Oh, I don't want a boy for a man's job.
Well,
Far be it for me to take food out of a boy's mouth, but, yeah, I could use a job. For a few days.
Be my guest. Or should I say, be my help.
No, you just be my banker and give me $15 a day.
Got her! Oh, I love that.
Did they think?
I love that exchange.
They had to think that was funny. They had to know that was yes. funny. That, this yes. is the movie's sense of humor. He is so not into her until later on, and she's like skinny dipping, and then he's very much into her. But at that moment, he's like, just shut up, little girl, and get me money. That's what I want.
It was so great. I wish that would have gone on forever. Just like, be my help, be my bank, be my friend, be my enemy, be my neighbor, be my roommate. Like, I wish it would have gone for... I wish it would have just gone on forever. I wish that was just the rest of the movie.
You know, if they cut out... If you didn't watch... If you just, like, walked in on this movie when it's playing in a theater or on TV and you miss the opening sequence... He's a pretty cool guy up to this point, right?
Yeah.
She's throwing herself at him. He's got some like patter that he's mm-hmm. throwing at her. And he seems to be, you know, cool as a cucumber. I mean, I could see you kind of connecting with this guy. I like to see him as the center of the movie for a little bit. And mm-hmm. while Arlene is, honestly, she's my favorite character in the entire movie because A, she's just awful. And she is extremely horny all the time. I mean, really reflective of the type of people that grow in Quebec, I suppose.
And she's quick to use on any guy that will give her a chance. The old, can you put some suntan lotion on my back move? Mm-hmm. And, you know, up to this point, he's been pretty respectable, cleaning up the house, taking care of things. Then she asks for the lotion on the back. He gets a little too aggressive. That doesn't worry her. She doesn't mind. She's nope. like, no big deal. No yellow flags. No warning signs going off here. Must be totally fine. No big deal. Let's go on a long hike and climb up to the mountain. And then, you know, we'll hang out there where no one's around and no one can hear me scream. And that's when he decides, let's go ahead and I'll just, he's trying to kiss her. She's playing coy. So he tries to choke her out, to which she says,
you're crazy. You trying to do, kill me?
No, but the only way to catch an eel is to grab it by the neck.
Ah, the classic
mm-hmm. line, which you know, NWPPVIPs all know the best way to catch an eel is with a horse head. So
oh yes put it on the hook. You gotta swing it around. Get it in the water.
Bang your tin drum. Are we still talking about tin drum? Fuck.
Oh. Bang your tin drum.
She, like, as Mark says, she's sunbathing on a high rocky surface. Mm-hmm. And that's when Bill reveals his weird dream.
It's a vague and shadowed shape. And I can never make it out or understand it. I was obsessed by this dream, particularly by the fourth figure. And finally, the doctors at the hospital asked me to paint a picture of my dream, which might help to cure my guilty, tormented mind. And I tried and I tried, but I always failed.
You talk about yellow flags. This dream is the red flag. This dream is like, I got no, you know what? I was unwise here and I need mm-hmm. to admit that to myself. You should mm-hmm. not be in my home
yeah.
where I also yeah. am. That's not good.
Yeah. You know, I think I can clean the freezer. You know, now that I think about it, I'm pretty good with the chisel.
It's not going to take me that long.
Right. I think we're good. I think we're good.
He says all that and she's like, I can fix him. I can fix him.
Look, if she could stand still, maybe she could have fixed him.
She's always been a wiggle worm.
At this point, too, he starts to sketch her.
Yeah.
And he does a sketch and she moves. And any time a woman moves, he gets really frustrated, which we end up finding out with sort of why, but not really. and so she grabs he tries to crumple up the paper. She takes a look at it and she says, oh, this is really good. You're an artist. And says, when did you start painting? Now, he's drawn this picture.
Yeah. That's a presumption on her part.
That's the equivalent to like someone hearing me on this podcast and saying, "When did you become a radio DJ?" Like, I mean, sort of similar in ways, but I'm not.
Yeah, right. She does last a while, Arlene. That's why she's our female protagonist for the most part. She lasts a good while, but she is the first really to go after our opening kill. And it's a bummer because usually a nighttime swim and then you walk through the trees in your negligee, it's a safe thing to do no matter what stranger you've invited to live in in your house with you. And normally that's totally safe, but for some weird reason, this time it's not. And he follows her, watches her swim, and then murders her in the forest. Who could have seen that coming?
I mean, when I was a kid, you didn't need to lock your doors, right? Right? You could just walk around free. You never had to worry about it. Where have things gone wrong that you can't walk around in your negligee with your ass showing and just let, you know, let nature take its course?
Yeah,
that's right. Was this like the 1960s train spotting where people were like, oh, shit, this stuff can hurt you? I didn't realize that. I didn't know. I had no idea.
No.
It's a cautionary tale is what we're
like, oh, damn. I had to be careful around strangers. I did not know that. I did not know that. I thought I'd just have sex with literally somebody I'd said one word to. I did not know that I had to be fearful of them.
That part where she turns to the camera and says, guess there'll be no consequences. I guess that could have been the tip off.
That part is great. I love that part. That's probably my favorite scene. When she turns the camera as she's being choked and just like kind of shrugs. Who knew? But with Arlene gone, we now are into the movie. The rest of the movie is Bill on his own, getting his work done, finally getting some work done. But he is officially our main character. This is not a two-hander. And whether you like it or not, we are on the I need to paint my dream journey. And he goes after additional women. Some he fools with fake job offers. Others he picks up at bars where they are singing. Sometimes they're already in the house.
Oh. Oh. There is someone here. The door was open, so I just walked in. Where's Arlene?
She isn't here right now.
Oh.
Who are you?
I'm a friend of Arlene's. You work here?
Yes, I do. Arlene hired me to work around the place, clean up, you know, close it for the winter.
I called last night, but there was no answer on the telephone. George and I thought we might drive over and visit.
George?
My husband. George and I thought we might come, but... Well, then I changed my mind, and I sent George away for a few days. So I am alone, and I'm quite free.
When you come up with a story for a movie, guess what? All the babes are throwing themselves at you.
One of the things I like about this movie is all the women are three-dimensional, right? You can really see an inner life in...
She seems like a real person. it's so funny because she starts out going, my husband. And I'm like, good for you, lady. Let him know that her husband's right around the corner. And then she goes, but he's gone. And I'm alone. And I'm like, no.
I'm very strangleable right now.
I could easily be murdered at this moment. Unbelievable. And so he does. He actually takes her and almost kills her. But what's incredible about this movie, and so spoilers for this movie, if you've listened to what we've said so far and said, I need to watch this, go watch it and pick up this episode later. But what happens is that a power outage goes off and a guy comes by to tell him, oh, yeah, hey, your power's off. And he's like, oh, shit, because that means all the bodies in his freezer are unfreezing. Defrosting, if you will. And this must be a Canadian thing. I don't know. But the utility guy's like, let me go inside the house to offer more explanation for the power outage.
Hey, that guy seems concerned about something. I better follow him in, see what it's all about. You just wander downstairs, just look in every room I can find.
I'm just here to just, you know, hey, you seem like worried about something. Maybe you need a buddy to help you out.
Maybe he was like, this guy, he's so handsome. I got to check out what he's all about.
This guy's irresistible. I got to know what's on this guy's mind.
He's got riz.
He's got all the riz.
Doug, you were talking about how things have changed over time. You know, when the guy from the electric company comes to the house. Now, if like the guy from the electric company or even the cable guy comes to my house, they ring the doorbell once. If I don't answer in 30 seconds, they run back to the truck and take off.
Yeah. So the Canadian way is to knock 700 times in different patterns.
I'm gonna keep knocking. Knock, knock, knock. Nope, he must be in there. Nope. I'll stay here. I got all day. I was like, wow, that is a committed electrical guy.
I've got to let this house know that they don't have power, but it's coming back. I have to let them know.
I like how like 99.9% of people would be like, yeah, I know we don't have power. I'm in the house. There's no power here.
But it's coming back. He doesn't know, though. That's the thing. He's unaware. The one person. And then I do love the ending of this movie, how he goes in and it. Now, it takes forever. They've set this bit up and it takes forever for the execution of it. But I love that it's just simply that he has set up one of his victims with a bow and arrow so well that arrow is pulled all the way back. Because God forbid he has to invent a little bit with his drawing and actually make it look like she's... No, he has to... She has to
is
really
it my
be
favorite
frozen.
Scene? Yes.
Okay.
I have to think about the mechanics of this a little bit, which is that he would have to bring her into the freezer, put the bow in her hand, pull it taut, and then just stand there until she freezes.
Exactly. Because you're like, either rigor mortis or being frozen have to kick in, so I'm just going to stand in this freezer for the next, I don't know, 8 to 12 hours holding this bow back until she can hold on. That logistically is impossible.
He's just he's holding it and going, this is probably another hour she'll be frozen enough. I'm good. I'll just hold it for one more hour.
He's like, I'm a very talented artist, but I'll tell you, drawing a bow and an arrow is just beyond
it's me. Too much. It's too much to invent. It's too much.
That's so funny. I didn't even think about that when I was watching it. But what I did think about was like, oh, they look so pretty frozen. Like, I've got some frozen
I think about
meat.
That every time I see a woman in a movie.
Yeah, like,
how would they
so
look in
frozen.
My industrial size freezer?
No, because like I have meat that we have frozen in the freezer and it looks like absolute shit. It's like frosted over. It looks disgusting. You have to like break off the ice to see what it is.
But have you taken the time to pose it properly?
That's correct. Yes.
Well,
right.
Lessons learned.
Yeah.
Lessons learned.
Right. Like in the time old tradition of taking your frozen meat and making it into some sort of vignette. That's just, that's how.
Yeah. The time old tale of that. Okay.
It might not have come through. It might not have come through in our little discussion of it so far, but he was very upset when these women moved and he was trying to sketch them. So what he has decided to do is kill them, freeze them into the positions he wants to have them in the painting, right? So they can be... So is he taking them out every once in a while to work? I feel like we could have used a couple of scenes of that to kind of establish a little bit what the hell he's doing.
He can't draw with the freezer door open because that would, that would be like the power's off. Like he can't, he just has to keep putting his head in the freezer and going, okay, close it. And then goes back to drawing. Cause it looks like when he's painting, he's looking off camera and you're like, what is he looking at? But he has these women in the freezer. He can't have the door wide open. Cause then they'll defrost, right? Like he can't do that.
Once this guy gets a Polaroid camera, his mental illness is just going to leave. He'll be fine for the rest of his day.
Which I think that existed then. I think he could have. This could have been avoided.
Aww.
Well, not on a drifter's salary.
Yeah. You buy a Polaroid camera on $15 a day for 2 days.
Not on a drifter's salary. Oh, my God.
Erica?
Yes? Oh, it's time for things we love and things we hated.
That's right. We're going to talk about the things we love, the things we hated about Playgirl Killer. Mark, what did you love?
I loved the scene where Pat, who has come to the house because she saw an ad in the paper for a companion.
A companion.
So she's come to the house. And Bill says, would you like some iced tea? She said, yes, I'd love some. So he goes inside and he gets two glasses of iced tea. And one of them, he drops in a couple pills. Don't know what they are, but presumably they're going to have a negative effect. And he grabs the two glasses of iced tea and he walks out.
They're just ibuprofen. He just is like, you look like you got a little headache or some muscle pain. I'm just going to look up. Maybe a slight fever.
All right. So let's assume they're sleeping pills.
Yeah, sure.
And so he drops them in there. And you see this scene where he comes out with the two glasses of iced tea and the door shuts behind him. And she's looking at him and he smiles. And I just thought, it is in that moment that I would have been, if this was me, I would have been like, fuck, which one did I put the pills in? fuck. And not to raise suspicion, because I'd be like, don't turn around and go back in the house, because then you'll wonder why. I would have sat there and been like, okay, we're going to drink this, and certainly would have been passed out cold on the table.
This is why Mark didn't go down this road, because he was like, I can't pull this off. I'm not good at this.
The only thing that stopped him from murder.
You know what? I'm just not going to murder people, I guess, then.
Yeah. My memory isn't sound, so it's a tale as old as time. I'm not going to murder.
Yeah.
He drinks it, goes for a swim, face down for the rest of the movie.
Would have been an odd twist, for sure.
Yep.
Doug, what did you love?
Oh, no. You know, I mentioned it already. I think the visual flourishes on the dream sequence are actually pretty interesting, right? I mean, it's ambitious in a way that you really wouldn't expect out of a movie like this. And it really is the most visually striking part of the entire movie. And it is fun that it becomes this kind of visual palette that they use for the painting that he is... It's kind of funny because they don't really go to the painting that much. It really is something that kind of just gets established. And then in the final like 20 minutes or so, it becomes this kind of motif. But it's a really interesting one, right? Like he's painting these women into his dream. And there's this mysterious figure. Who could it be? I'm obsessed with who could it be. Listeners, who do you think it's going to end up being? Why, it's the man himself. I like the painting aspect of it. I think in terms of this sort of like artist gone mad thematic thing that was going through a lot of movies at the time period, I'm not saying it's the best or anything like that, but I do like this kind of general concept. I just feel like they don't introduce his obsessions, even though they do in the opening scene. I don't think they introduce it in a way that's coherent until like the second half of the movie. It feels like they're just like, I was going to say Paul Anka again, but I mean, they got Neil Sedaka. Right. We got to get him into it. We got to have a little storyline for him to do. It just feels like they're spinning their wheels for so long, which is funny for a movie that's barely 90 minutes, if not even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I said a few things I didn't like too.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that.
Sometimes
in a second
the things
too,
you so. Like.
Maybe you have some left. Erica, what did you love?
I liked all the pretty ladies that were in it. That was nice.
I want to change my answer.
But I'll save my next little comment for things I hated. I like all the pretty ladies that were in it.
I love the music. There's some cool music in here. And I'm going to just point out the song Montage here, which is sung by André Champagne.
I'll translate it.
Quand le soir tombe, mon cœur de...
Don't put me in a freezer is what she's saying.
That's appropriate. She had no idea how appropriate that was at the time.
That's what I sound like when I do my opening songs. No one needs to comment whether that's true or not. That's just Something that I believe that is not open for discussion.
Yeah, I thought that was like a lovely little song that sort of, you know, just came out of nowhere. I mean, obviously we'd had music already, which is like, wow, this is kind of crazy. I mean, I knew Neil Sedaka was in the movie, and then you see the first scene with him and he's just like in a pool and you're like, is this like a movie where Neil Sedaka is just going to play a dude and he's not even going to, and then he does sing and you're like, okay, I get it.
Can you imagine walking out of Bonnie and Clyde in 1968 and walking into the Playgirl Killer and thinking, this movie's got Neil Sedaka in it and it's like a horror movie about this guy I'm going to see Neil Sedaka sliced and diced on camera. Instead, he gets away scot-free. He even gets... he gets like two women drooling all over him and he walks out of the movie 20 minutes in.
Yeah. Well, talking about things I hated, let's talk about things we hated. Mark, what did you hate?
Well, I didn't like that about 15 minutes of this movie are full songs, but what really drove me nuts is both the Neil Sedaka song and the song that we just listened to, in the scenes, neither of them are using microphones. So why isn't the audience, like, someone in the back going, like, dude, we can't hear you, man. Can't hear you at all. Like, nobody, we're supposed to just
you
assume.
You need to amplify your voice with a microphone.
Right. The band that's playing at first has a microphone. He didn't even think to borrow it. He's just like, now I'll wing it. But you would have just had pure music and then the faint sound of someone singing. Maybe if you were close enough.
Neil Sedaka doesn't need a microphone. He transcends microphone.
I'm glad we found the sole logical flaw in this movie.
It's the only thing that doesn't
work. It's the only one. That's the only time they slipped.
Thank you.
Doug, what did you hate?
This might sound a little strange. One of the things I hated was something that was just missing from the movie generally that you would kind of expect to be there, considering the pedigree of the people involved, which is there's no gore, right? It starts with someone being shot with a harpoon gun. And I mean, it's violent, certainly for the time. It was certainly the time it was made as opposed to when it was released. But I mean, considering this is about a mad killer and it is definitely in the mold of those Herschel Gordon Lewis movies, you kind of would expect that in terms of the things that they would copy, even if it wasn't extreme, you know, splatter, that it would still be pretty violent, but it just isn't. It's not, you know, I mean, you get that great kind of shock visual of the frozen bodies at the end, which is very memorable and it's really cool. But, you know, the killings otherwise are not very creative.
I agree. And I wonder if it's the Sedaka of it all that sort of makes them think we can't go and... Even though this seems aimed at the exact same exploitation market that Herschel Gordon Lewis made his movies for, that Roger Corman made his movies for, they're like, but this one's got Sedaka. We got to go a little classy here. We can't get too heavy on the blood.
I wanted to see his severed head playing Canadian football with Neil Sedaka's severed head.
Erica, what did you hate?
Watching it, I recall hating that I didn't really know what the movie was about. I was like, is this just about a tortured artist who, does he hate ladies? Does he hate that he can't complete his art? Like, what's his motivation? I found that I hated that while I was watching it. But then when it ended, I just sort of more honed in on something very specific, which was the final lady that comes in and is like, I have a husband, but he's gone. I was like, so we don't care if she dies then because she's unfaithful. I don't know. Like, it just, I didn't love everybody up to that point. I was like, oh no, like this isn't fair. But with her, I was like, yeah, tie her up. She needs to learn a lesson.
There are hints at something that would not have been uncommon with horror movies of that time period, which is his disinterest towards women who are coming on to him might represent, you know, a sexual proclivity, I was going to say. But, you know, he could be a queer character, or at least a coded queer character of that time period.
Well, you've seen a movie or two before, Doug. All right. You can't fool me.
Well, we kept that streak alive. I things I hated. I mean, I will say that I do appreciate the fact that when we, you know, started this podcast, I did not think we'd be talking about some weird mid-60s Herschel Gordon Lewis like thriller movie. And so of that kind of vein of films.
Well, that's so weird. That's exactly what I thought we would be talking about. How funny. 100%. How funny. Yeah. That's odd.
You were hoping. You were really like, yeah. You were very hoping. And so it's interesting that we would talk about a movie like this. That said, again, I'm just not the biggest fan of a movie with the antagonist being the main character, especially when this is not going deep into character. I don't know what you do. Again, the cops are, that's kind of boring to bring in the cops, but yeah, just
sorry,
didn't
Neil
love that.
Sedaka has dropped out of college to become a private detective.
That's right. Now we're talking. Right, now we're talking. I see a series of movies. I see a TV show. Now we're talking.
Nice.
But let's switch to favorite scene. Mark, what was your favorite scene?
We already talked about it. The frozen bow and arrow at the end. Just logistically, I don't know how you make that happen. I don't know how you make that work. I don't know how you freeze yourself in the process of trying to set that all up. But pulling back a bow, the string of a bow, I don't know the exact terminology. I'm sure someone is listening right now going, dude, come on.
We got a lot of bow and arrow fans in this podcast.
But well, it's a lot not of archery, easy. Archers. It's not. Yeah, a lot of archers. That's like the Archcast, which we're going to be starting next month,
right.
Is going to be really great, guys. So stick around for that.
There's nothing archers like more than talking about archery.
Exactly.
Not doing it, but...
And it's going to be, you know, just a bunch of arch heads like us that know how to really do it. It is difficult to pull that thing back. So to get someone to freeze in that position, impossible.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. Doug, your favorite scene? Can you even pick just one?
Oh, so many are just running through my head right now. Actually, what is really running through my head, something I read earlier today that I didn't bring up when you brought out that the actress who played Arlene was dating Rich Little. She later dated Alan Thicke. What a romantic life that woman had. So obviously my brain is searching for anything to talk about other than the greatest scenes in this movie. Honestly, my brain, when I'm thinking about the movie, that ending is definitely what the highlight. I mean, it's the clear highlight, but really I think my favorite part is what happens immediately before that. Just the guy coming to the door, knocking 700 times, him answer the door, hearing that the power is off and just like losing his mind and just running and just like having no care at all about the fact that the door is wide open and all that sort of thing.
And he's like, I've had to talk people through these power outages many times. I'm going to go into his house, really talk mm-hmm. him through what it's like to not have power.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
I'm going to relate to him. I want to make sure he's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I just want to say that Bill Kerwin is not the worst actor in the world. I think he's pretty okay. He had a long, like very, I was going to say distinguished career, maybe not distinguished, but varied. And it lasted a long time, which is almost as good as being good. And he does carry this role, I think, with a certain amount of offbeat charm, which you wouldn't expect because he's such a button-down guy in those Herschel Gordon Lewis movies. It's nice to see him kind of stretch his legs a little bit in a role where he gets to grow some facial hair and be really turned off by someone throwing themselves at him and also just murdering people sort of without any clear motive for much of the movie. So I'm just going to give a special golden scratch and sniff star to Bill Irwin in this episode.
Yes.
I said Bill Irwin. Bill Kerwin, of course.
If Bill Irwin was in this movie, it would have been hilarious. Erica, what is your favorite scene?
My favorite scene was impromptu horseback ride because I don't know how many times horses have gotten me out of a jam. You know, like someone's not into you. You're just like, you know what? Give me another chance. I got a couple horses. Mm. Let's ride. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it turns things around. So, yeah, impromptu horse ride was my favorite.
Oh, I want to change my answer. My favorite scene was the post-credit sequence where her father returns with a lion carcass over his shoulder walking in the front door.
He's got the head ready to, like, mount up on the wall. Honey, I'm back.
Arlene, honey.
The whole time he's been thinking, I can't wait to get this in the freezer. Uh-oh.
I'm going to have so much lion meat to put in my freezer. Oh.
Yeah, I'm with you, Mark. I also love the ending scene. I don't know how it's hard to beat. It's probably the most unique part of the movie is that ending scene. So that was definitely my favorite as well. So let's just move on to final questions. Did Arlene's sister plan a backyard concert and a cabaret dance? Or was the dance a surprise?
The fact that she was crying leads me to believe it was a surprise.
Yeah, I think the crying is a dead giveaway.
Yeah, that's a dead ringer. Yeah.
I also have sympathy about crying. Is it obvious?
I mean, she has a real Jolene situation going on with her sister.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
She's like, her man, Neil Sedaka, is powerless for her when she just strips down to her underwear in front of him all the time.
Like most dudes who were of college age plus 10.
Mm-hmm. 10? Come on, Ryan.
15. Do you think Bob ever admits to his affair with Arlene, or does he just kind of keep that on the down low?
I don't think he needs to. I'm pretty sure everybody knew what was going on.
He's going to bring it up on the car ride. I had a wild night last night.
Your sister was
so tired. College.
Now that we're at college, your sister really, she's wild. She really came on to me. And I said, yes. Anyway, see you in class. For $15 a day, do you actually need to do any work? Because it felt like...
I mean, for $15 a day, I would rub oil on a hot lady's back and fold three chairs. It seems like a great deal.
I love that he's back there behind her smoking a cigarette and just throwing the chairs on top of you. She's like folding lawn chairs, like as if that's like a real ton of work.
Yeah.
And he's just like, oh, you're just sitting there doing nothing. It's like,
yeah,
you're not either, really. I mean, if we're really being honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm doing I have an inflation calculator here. $15 in Canadian money in 1965 is worth $147.28 here in 2025.
Wow. So that's So he's like getting nearly $300 for 2 days of not doing anything.
Yeah. Nice. And room and board. And I mean, he's probably has access to the meat in the freezer too.
Indeed he does. Yeah. He adds to it.
Mm-hmm. And entertainment.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. You've just met someone. And they immediately invite you to take a swim with them wearing a stranger's bathing suit. Yes or no?
Wait, am I wearing the bathing suit or are they?
You are. You have to. You don't know them and they're like, I can't swim or I don't want to go in the pool because I don't have a bathing suit. No problem. I got a stranger's bathing suit that you can wear.
Yeah.
Are you in?
It's a no for me, dog, because it's somebody's sister's bathing suit. I can't risk it.
Yeah.
It's a no for me, dog.
I'm less worried about the stranger because I've been in a public pool and didn't seem to have a real problem with it. It's more of the putting on someone else's bathing suit. That's a hard no for me.
Yep.
The next time I turn down a free swim in someone's private pool will be the first time. I'm in there with bells on.
Yes,
I love that. I love that.
He says, who cares? Get your brother's trunks. So what? Right. I'm going in.
Doug, I'm surprised you're still alive. With that kind of laissez-faire attitude.
Have you ever seen how Doug holds still?
Yeah, that's it.
That's how you've lived.
That's how.
Oh, man.
So many portraits painted of Doug.
Who's back here? That's funny.
Do you think Bill, like, when he unwrapped the wrapper of a Tootsie Roll and saw the kid with the bow and arrow, he was like, fuck, how did that guy draw that? I don't know. I don't know how he did that.
Wasn't that you had to find one with two of them on it? And
I think it was the star also.
Oh, the star.
The star.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a whole generation that has no idea what we're talking about, and I'm not going to bother to explain it. Don't even worry about it.
Google it.
Google it on your Google machines. Okay. Who is replacing Nikki at the Royal Embassy Hotel's Roof Garden Cafe?
Oh.
Paul Anka, of course.
Half Canadian. Oh, yeah, of yes, course. Of course.
Oh, my God. Of course. That's where he comes in. He gets his big break in there.
Good call.
So, pulling a Bob, we talked about this before we started recording, where you could just show up for like 20 minutes and then bounce out of it. If we were to pull a Bob, and so, Doug, think about your own podcast, but Mark, Erica, if you were to pull a Bob in one of our episodes, which one do you wish you could go back and pull the Bob? And Doug, for your podcast, the same thing. What do you think? If you could have just shown up and been like, you know what? I'm in 20 minutes. I feel like I've got out what I got to do, and I'm going to bounce and let the rest of the episode do what it needs to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. That's...
I have like five ready to go if you don't agree
okay,
with my
go
first
ahead.
Yeah,
one.
Go so, for it.
Oh, cries and whispers. Whispers and cries. I'm out. Crimes of Passion. See ya. Tin Drum. Bye-bye. Gotta go. Yeah. So many. I'm out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Generation X is a definite one that I would be
oh, no.
taking a hard jump.
Like, oh, no.
Oh, I would have bailed out of that so fast.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy.
Jimmy the Kid, I would have also been, I wish I could have pulled the parachute on that one and been like, mm-hmm. I'll see you guys on the ground. I'm out. But Doug, yeah. Is there an episode you can think of?
Immediately to mind. I was once invited on this podcast to talk about this movie called The Playgirl Killer. And I just said,
yes.
Actually, my real answer is, so I joke a little bit about the difficulties of having an Eric Roberts themed podcast, which is that he makes a lot of movies and some of them are not very good.
No.
But it can be fun to talk about a bad movie. We talked about a few that were more painful than just regular bad. And one of them was called Chicks Dig Gay Guys, which has Eric Roberts playing an extremely offensive stereotype gay man in it. And it is really, I mean, he's not even in it that long. The whole movie is terrible. But I remember watching it and thinking, this isn't just bad. It's also fraught, you know, just talking about it makes me a little uncomfortable. And then, of course, you still got to have a guest on and talk about it for 2 hours. So, yeah, I kind of wish I could have bounced from that. Yeah, kind of wish it doesn't exist in the universe. One other one that just sprung to mind, which is because I was just talking about something fraught. There's an Australian movie from like 1983 that we covered on our Carol Kane podcast. That podcast, by the way, is a chronological podcast. So we are watching everything
in
Carol
order,
Kane has
yes.
ever done in wow. order, wow. including wow. television work. And she made a movie in Australia in like 1983 called Norman Loves Rose about a 12-year-old who gets a woman, like a woman in her 20s pregnant. And it's a light comedy. And it is, it's just bad, of course, but it's also baffling that anyone, it's like that, what's that movie with Michael Caine, that really infamous one from the 80s where he's
Blame
being,
It on Rio?
Yes, Blame It on Rio, where he's being seduced by like a 13 or 14 year old. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that kind of creepy, weird, uncomfortable.
Have you, on your Eric Roberts podcast, have you gotten to the Wolves of Wall Street?
Oh yes, the David Dakota class. Look, I mean, we've done Bigfoot versus DB Cooper. I mean, we've been through the mud.
I gotta catch up.
I'll tell you what, of the Eric Roberts David Dakota collaborations, and there's been I think a lot. I think Wolves of Wall Street might be the best movie of all.
Oof.
So that just tells you,
Wolves of Wall Street amazing. It's about a bunch of young guys on Wall Street who are werewolves. Do they turn into werewolves? They do not. It is.
I mean, when he said it was directed by David Dakota, you could have just said, you didn't need to say a bunch of young guys. It's implied that there's going to be
it's
a bunch
implied.
Of them.
You know. All right. Let's get into some research real quick. We don't have a ton here. As we've already mentioned, it's shot in the summer of 1965. It does not come out for several years. In fact, it releases in the U.S. first, of all places, opening in Lima, Ohio in August 1967. Mostly as a second feature with the diabolical Dr. Z. But it also played with Color Me Blood Red in Lima, Ohio, which is irony on top of irony. And then in cities like Boston later in 1967, it plays with Bloodbath, including on Christmas Day. So you could see diabolical Dr. Z, Playgirl Killers, and Bloodbath on Christmas and Boxing Day. In 1967, so what a treat. It has its Montreal debut, July 26, 1968, at the Strand Theater, which is at the theater that is depicted as Bill is taking a drive down the street. I forget what street he drives down, but he drives, because I've never been to Montreal, so I have no idea. But I did read which one it was. And then eventually, of course, New World picked it up for probably 40 cents in a bag
of magic beans.
Yeah. And a bag of Big League Chew. They were like, here you go. Can we have this movie? They're like, absolutely. I really just want to take a whole bunch of that Big League Chew and just stuff it into the side of my mouth like a baseball player, as advertised on the package. Anyway, a lot of people don't know.
I gotta warn you, it looks like garbage. Perfect.
A lot of people don't know what I'm talking about there. Don't worry about it. Just Google it on your Google machines. And it's released on New World Video August 17th, 1986, against Bliss. Bliss is the other New World movie coming out. It's an Australian movie, which sells for $79.95.
Wow.
Yep. The winner of the 1985 Australian Academy Award for Best Picture, Bliss. Hmm. It's on Daniel Waters' top movies of 1985 on his list that he did at that time.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Playgirl Killer from New World, $59.95.
Dang. A bargain.
Yeah. Worth every penny.
Yep. Worth it. Their description for this that I found of Playgirl Killer for its video release, it says, a psychotic artist becomes obsessed with a series of beautiful women he paints, then kills. Totally incorrect. He kills them and then he paints them. It's the wrong order. He doesn't become obsessed with a series of beautiful women. He's obsessed with a dream, and he finds beautiful women who are throwing themselves at him. Then he kills them. Then he paints. It's all wrong.
He's really the opposite of obsessed with the women themselves. He could take or leave them, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I wish this is a podcast. I wish I could share the picture on the video box for people to see for the VHS. It's just so funny because it looks like it's like – and it's the 80s, it's mid 80s, but it looks like a 90s thriller. It looks like, oh man, it's going to get real sexy times. Not at all what this movie is. And what's amazing about, should you pick up the DVD of Playgirl Killer, is they do have a section where they sort of play audio and they just throw you bits and pieces of those pictures from that photo shoot of people that, of course, are not in this movie. And it just has like snippets of it. Even that it made it to this DVD. I don't know how it made it to this DVD, but it has like photos from the New World photo shoot that they didn't use for the cover. It's amazing. Also has a quiz, a 5-question quiz.
Wow.
Just in case you weren't paying attention. They're like,
if you fail it, you got to watch the movie again.
What's that, Mark?
Is that how you got your final questions?
No. The questions are like ridiculously easy. I was even like, maybe I should do the quiz for everybody. And I went through it and I was like, no, this is fucking boring. It's so easy. Like, it's like, and they're multiple choice. So it's like, how does Bob kill his first victim? It's like, fucking harpoon. Like, I didn't miss that. I didn't fall asleep. They're like, it's like that simple. Bob is what? A? Insane, you know, it's like, yeah, yeah, of course. Anyway, that is it. That is Playgirl Killer on Vidtober. Doug, thank you so much for joining us for this episode.
I mean, I didn't want the applause at the beginning, but now I do feel like I deserve it.
You made it to the end. You deserve the applause. Your final thoughts on Playgirl Killer, a movie I'm sure near and dear to the hearts of everyone in Canada.
I mean, it is not a movie that has really any reputation at all in the world, in Canada or elsewhere. But,
sure.
I mean, I think we made a passing reference to the fact that it is the first color horror movie ever made in Canada. And gosh darn it, that's substantial, right? That's an important thing. It opened the door for all of those wonderful color Canadian horror movies. I'm being a little facetious, but think about it, right? I mean, you got to have the first before you have your David Cronenberg, right? Before you have your Prom Night, before you have all of those tax shelter movies.
Visiting Hours. I mean, how do you?
Yeah, absolutely, right? So you don't get that without this movie. And for that, we must thank it, even if we must not necessarily watch it.
So please go check out Doug and at Cinema Smorgasbord. Smorgasbord. God, no, I can't say it. And go to and check out the many, many podcasts that he's doing. If you want to follow the rest of our Vidtober 2 selections, go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where you find all of our interviews, our episodes, our t-shirts. Buy a t-shirt. We have a new shop with lots of new designs. And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
And everyone, have fun. And what a bug.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network, please select the link in the description